Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so this evening is the Asala Puja, the full moon of July, which is the commemoration of the Buddha's first teaching, and then also it's the tomorrow is the beginning of the traditional rains retreat. So in Buddhist history, this is recounted as the day when the Buddha met up with his five spiritual companions who he had practiced with, and done all sorts of ascetic trainings with them, and then when he had the insight into that one, this isn't working, and there's got to be a better way than this, and then he started to eat so that he could have more physical energy. And which was considered he's abandoning his determination. He's reverting to a worldly way of life. So then those five ascetics abandoned him and went off and practiced elsewhere, because they ended up in Sarnath, in the deer park near Benares. And it was the Buddha continued his practice and training in a more moderate way, but still assiduous in his training, or dedicated to his training, to find liberation, but try to find it in a balanced way, and he did, and that was, that took place the full moon of May, after his awakening, then the Buddha spent time, as is in the accounts, he's delighting in the bliss of awakening, having put forth all this tremendous effort, and also reviewing the not just his life, his existence since his human birth, but reflecting back on all the many births that he had taken in the wandering of samsara, and the many forms of birth and lives that he had lived, and delighting in the fact that he was free, he was liberated. He was no longer bound by by the world. And then deciding to teach, realize, and that wasn't his first inclination. His first inclination after his awakening was that nobody's going to understand this. This is too subtle, too refined, too much against the grain of the ordinary human mind. And that there's an idiom that comes up in the discourses over and over again, and bound by ignorance and obstructed by craving. And that's so that being bound and tied down by ignorance, delusion, and obstructed, or there's these things that keep getting in the way, and that's craving, that desire, that seeking, you know, one of them is bad enough, but that double whammy is really tough. And because it keeps us spinning, keeps us entangled. And so it's so hard to find a place of peace, a place of real freedom. Like in the invitation to give a Dhamma talk that Desmond recited, as a traditional request for a Dhamma talk, that's actually a quote from the discourses, which is an account of the Brahma Sahampati inviting the Buddha to recollect or remember that there are beings with little dust in their eyes. There are people who will understand. And then that's the arising of compassion in the Buddha and his determination that, yes, okay, there will be people who will understand. And then that precipitated his reflecting on, well, who would understand this first? That was okay. These five ascetics who I practice with are really sincere. They're really dedicated, and if I teach them, they will. No, they'll understand this. They'll catch on to this, and so he determined to go. And he sort of thought within his intuition and realized, okay, they're in the deer park at outside of Benares. And for anybody who's been to India on pilgrimage, from Bodh Gaya, the place of the Buddha's enlightenment, to the deer park at Isipatana, that's about 200 kilometers. So, you know, the Buddha really determined to make that commitment to go and teach, because there weren't any tour buses in those days, and it was get on one of the pilgrimage tour buses and go from Bodh Gaya to Sarnath. And they didn't exist. He had to walk the whole way. And while he was walking, another wandering religious seeker saw the Buddha and was inspired by his demeanor, inspired by his presence. And you can imagine the Buddha. I mean, one, he's a warrior noble. He's he's in his mid-30s, 35, because he left home at 29. He was 6 years of ascetic practices. So he's 35. He's kind of physically at a kind of a peak and as a human being. And then, say, spiritually, he's had this incredible realization of full awakening. And so you can imagine it'd be quite a presence. And that religious seeker went up to him and asked him, he said, you seem composed, you seem radiant, you seem bright. Who's your teacher? Who's teaching do you follow? And the Buddha gave a declaration of his accomplishment, saying, I have no teacher. I'm the first person who's been awakened in the world, and there's nobody else in the world who's fully awakened like me. And it was quite a declaration, and the religious seeker sort of it's like, whoa, that's a bit weird. And it's like, okay, may it be so, Venerable Sir, and then backed out of there real quick. Because you can imagine somebody coming up to you in the street, say in the streets of Yucatan. I mean, we do get this, something. They'll come up with their religious truth to come and tell us. And, you just want to get out of there real quick. So that happened to the Buddha. And he said, okay, that didn't work. And so that as he continued walking and wandering on to Sarnath, and how can I present these to you? I've experienced this truth, and I'm just making this up, but I'm sure that that's what went through the Buddha's mind. That really didn't work. This, even if it's true, it's like Ajahn Chah. He had an idiom that he would sometimes use. He said, it's true, but it's not correct. It's like it could be true, but it's really not right according to Dhamma. Or it's correct, but it's not true in the sense of, okay, yeah, you can speak something true, but then it's, so it's just too much truth all at once. And it's not helpful. There's no handle on it. So that, to reflect, how can I present this truth that I've realized in a way that people can take and practice with it, reflect on it, understand it for themselves? And that's where the Buddha came up with this formulation of the Four Noble Truths. Because that is a pointing to something that everybody can experience, they can know. Like the first noble truth of dukkha. Dukkha being suffering, it has many translations. Suffering, difficulty, stress, dis-ease, discontent, dissatisfaction. It's something that we all experience as human beings. I remember listening to a recording of Ajahn Chah giving a teaching in England. he was at a Tibetan center, the Manjushri Institute, and he brought up the Four Noble Truths, and he started off. He said, "Okay, the Buddha gave the his first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, and the first Noble Truth was the Noble Truth of, say, of suffering, of dukkha, of dissatisfaction, discontent." And he just sort of asked, "Has anybody never experienced some feeling of stress or difficulty or dukkha?" And so, of course, nobody said anything. And I think that that's, in the time of the Buddha, it was like that. Even now, it's like that. In the human condition, we experience this feeling of dukkha. And it's also, in order for it to be a noble truth, it is not sort of like, "Oh, woe is me, I'm experiencing dukkha, I'm a suffering person, I'm a miserable, why has it always happened to me?" That's not really a noble truth. But the noble truth is that it's a experience. There is suffering. There is dukkha. There is dissatisfaction. So it gives it the opportunity to take it away from the personal and bring it to the experiential. This is an experience that we all have. But it's also, when the Buddha used this structure of the Four Noble Truths, it's also interesting to note that he used this structure is the same structure in India that's used for medical diagnosis. So it's like there's the symptom of the disease. There's the cause of the disease. There's the prognosis or the possibility. Can this be cured? And then there's the actual, the way to treat oneself, or the cure that one has to follow. So that's what the Four Noble Truths are. There is dukkha. There is suffering. There is a cause, and so that there is an origin, there is a cause, there is various conditions that bring about this experience of dukkha. There's the possibility of its ending, its complete cessation, the complete ending of dukkha. One can be completely free of dukkha. And then there's the way of practice that will lead to that experience of the ending of dukkha. So that's when there's a treatment for this very common human condition of dukkha. So that the Buddha put it into a practical formulation that gives us something to do, gives us something to work with and to understand, and then to put our effort and energy into. So the sense of experience of dukkha is, again, it's not something that we have to be afflicted by. It's like there's always going to be some sort of difficulty, some sort of, say, pain in the human condition, just having a physical body, having the experience of separation from the loved, or association with the disliked, those are experiences of difficulty that we will all experience. Where the Buddha points to the worldly dhammas, there's always going to be praise and blame. There's always going to be gain and loss. Experiencing that and then adding dukkha to it, say the emotional dukkha, the feeling of resentment or the agitation that comes from that, the disturbance that comes from that, that's optional. That's something that we add to it. When I reflect back on, say, my experience of living with Ajahn Chah and seeing him deal with, all sorts of difficulties, responsibilities, and not being shaken by any of it. Not being moved by it, not being disturbed, not disturbing his loving kindness and compassion. And that's something that, as we practice with the Buddha's teachings, you realize that it opens the doorway. It's not just a kind of a cold insight into truth. Truth is like this, and then one separates away from it. What happens? What the real transformation of insight is that there's an arising of kind of compassion and loving kindness, and a sense of stability and equanimity. It's not shakeable. It's not movable. That's the underlying condition of the heart that sees truth that the Buddha gives us, seeing these Four Noble Truths in their true nature. So there is a cessation of dukkha. And however little we get to experience that or taste it, that gives us a kind of confidence and inspiration to continue to practice, to continue to put the Buddha's teaching into our life, and just learning how to recognize the patterns. One is to recognize the pattern of, this is dukkha. And I remember one time going to Ajahn Chah and, having either some kind of difficulty or obstacle or having some kind of view or opinion about something expressing that with Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah just, hey, is that dukkha? you look at it in a different way, because it's like our perspectives, our views, our how we think things should be or how they shouldn't be. Those all seem so real and solid, and then you have somebody like Ajahn Chah saying, looks like dukkha to me. I said, oh, okay. The one time there's a great story that Lumpa Samedo has told many times where he was just kind of fed up with having to do the chores in the afternoon, and having to, it sort of broke up his meditation time in the afternoon, and it was also really hot, and it was right in the mid-afternoon when it was the hottest. It was the most uncomfortable time to be doing chores, and then you sweep up the monastery and get it all cleaned up. Of course, it stirs up dust, and you're hot and sweaty, and then you're dirty and sweaty. So it's just, in his mind, he's kind of grumbling, complaining, why do we have to do this? And so then the bell goes for chores, and he's kind of puts it off and drags himself out to go do the chores. And of course, by the time he gets there, all the good brooms are gone, and he's sort of scratching away with this really second-rate broom, and he sees, oh, this is terrible, I'm not getting anywhere. And you sweep the leaves up and sweep the monastery up, and the leaves are falling behind you anyway, why do we do this? And Ajahn Chah walks past and he just asks, oh, is Wat Bapong suffering? Sumedho, is Wat Bapong suffering? And then walks away. And then, of course, Ajahn Sumedho, he's very reflective. And he says, Wat Bapong isn't suffering, it's me that's suffering. I'm the one who keeps adding suffering to everything. Wat Bapong is actually quite a beautiful place. It's a nice forest. Actually, if I'm not just grumbling, complaining, then, we've got a good teacher. We've got good people living here, lay people, or really, it's just me who's suffering. So that's not the feeling usually when we think, because it's not like the noble truth is suffering. It's me suffering. Mm-hmm. Why is suffering happening to me? Sort of the woe was me kind of suffering. But being able to turn that and say, there's this experience of suffering that we can learn from, we can understand. And that's exactly what the Buddha says. So he sees, there is these noble truths, but then there's also the relationship to those noble truths. And that's where the Buddha, like when we chanted the discourse, and the Buddha said this, there is this a noble truth of dukkha, and this dukkha has to be understood. The responsibility that we have to these noble truths. There is the noble truth, and then there's the response that we have to it. So the response to the noble truth of dukkha is that it's to be understood, it's to be known clearly. And similarly with the cause of dukkha. And the Buddha points to the cause as, of course, the different forms of craving. Sensual desire, desire for being, desire for annihilation. But that sense of that desire, that craving, but it's that craving and the Buddha said it's bound up with pleasure and lust. It's attracted to something with that kind of hit of pleasure, hit of delight. But ever seeking fresh delight. Now here, now there. So it's just like, say, that traditional image of the monkey that jumps from tree to tree, from branch to branch. It's our mind constantly looking for something else. That's what's going to make me happy. That's what's going to make me satisfied. If only I could get that. then I'd be okay. But it just continues, ever seeking fresh delight, now here, now there. And the Buddha says that our appropriate response to that craving, that desire, it's to be abandoned, it's to be relinquished, it's to be let go. And we can do that. We can just, because there's that natural response to reach out and grab, but we can relearn how that our response and abandon, let go, relinquish, recognizing that habit of desire, of craving is just that, it's a habit. And throughout our life we've gone through all sorts of different habits. When you see it as something that's not helpful, not useful, you can let it go. You can abandon it. It's like, say, like when I was growing up, just the vast majority of people, whether they're young or old or male or female, smoking cigarettes. It was just a habit. But it was sort of seen, okay, this is really not a good habit for anybody. And like nowadays, it's really, most people have, abandoned smoking for a long time now. Or most people young people don't even think to begin to start the habit, because it's just not used to it. It's not useful. It's not beneficial. So in the same, similarly, desire, craving, it's not all that useful. It's not that there aren't skillful desires. It's not that there isn't a form of desire that motivates us. And it's important that to recognize there is a distinction. The word that the Buddha uses in this teaching is the word tanha. And tanha is desire that's always bound up with dukkha. That's just its natural endpoint, is some form of suffering or discontent. But when the Buddha's teaching, there's other forms of desire that he says are really important. And the word is chanda. It's like the word chanda is desire, but it can be used in a positive way, so like motivation. And you can, and the word chanda is sort of like more of a neutral term, because there are negative forms of chanda, like in the teaching on the five hindrances, there's gama chanda, like sensual desire. And that's an obstruction, that's a hindrance. But chanda on its own is seen as positive, necessary, and he uses that in one of the teachings called the four Iddhipadas, the basis of spiritual success. And it's like chanda, virya, citta, vimamsa, desire, energy, application of mind, and investigation. Those are qualities. But starting with chanda, starting with desire, starting with motivation, so that there's skillful forms of desire that we have to cultivate, we have to develop. But the, say, tanha, it's always going to, it never ends well. So that's to be abandoned. That's always to be. So that the that second noble truth is learning how to learning how to relinquish, taking an interest, just not in some grand gesture that just one time and you're done with it, because it's something that you have to do over and over again. You have to learn how to recognize that desire, recognize craving, recognize those impulses as unskillful, and abandon it. And then not be upset when the mind goes back to it and picks it up and does it over again. It's like, remember Ajahn Chah saying, I can't remember the exact percentage, but I think it's some, like 80% of the practice is letting go of things and it not being, and then like the habit re-establishing itself. It's just the reality. It's the, you know, we're conditioned beings, just because we have a good idea, I'm going to get let go of my craving. That's a wonderful idea, but it takes more than just to think about it. It takes more than to even just try a little bit. Something that we have to be patient and consistent in continuing to do and to continue to let go, continue to cultivate and develop, to develop the clarity and the kind of stability, strength of heart. One of the things I think that's really important is, so often when we think of these Four Noble Truths and the teachings of the Buddha, oftentimes the mind goes to, dukkha, cause of dukkha. But we don't pay much attention to the cessation of dukkha. We don't really give enough interest in when does dukkha cease? When am I not discontent? When am I not dissatisfied? When am I not stressed? If we were all the time, then we'd be, probably, institutionalized. But the reality is we're not suffering all the time. We're not sort of filled with craving and greed all the time. It's just not our nature. The heart is always mixed, the mind is always mixed. So to learn how to pay attention to when the mind feels settled, feels clear, feels spacious. And oftentimes the problem is we skip over that, or we miss it. And so then we don't get the flavor of it. And so that cessation of dukkha is important to be. That's why the Buddha says the cessation of dukkha has to be realized. So we have to make it real for ourselves by recognizing it, seeing it, tasting it, feeling it. And we do experience it. We get glimpses of it from time to time. And so to give yourself the time to stay with that, even for a bit. And that's why it's so important to learn how to, it's like meditation. It's just learning how to stop. And this is the great diseases of the human condition is that we don't know how to stop. We just keep moving. The mind keeps moving. We keep going. And there's a certain physical busyness, but there's a a mental and emotional momentum that doesn't know how to stop, and just learning how to pay attention to that quality of stopping, of settling, of becoming quiet inside and letting things, because that's where the heart starts to really open up. So that sense of realizing that there is this possibility within our human experience, we have the possibility to connect with this cessation of dukkha, this ending of dukkha, because everything has a beginning and an end. I mean, it's the nature of all existence, and even we get excited about beginnings, but we don't pay attention to endings very well. And so that just learning how to shift attention so that we see the ending of dukkha, ending of some kind of proliferation that we have, an ending of a kind of mood that's been dogging us. And then recognize, oh yeah, there is an ending, even in a moment-to-moment experience. But of course, to have it more settled, more stable, more clear, that's where this path or a way leading to the cessation of dukkha. And this is the Noble Eightfold Path that the Buddha taught, which is the training in virtue, a training in a training of the heart, a mental training, a training in wisdom, and that sila, samadhi, panya. When it's training one's whole being, all our actions of body, speech, and mind, our interactions with the world around us, the inner qualities of effort and awareness, the aspects of discernment and wisdom, understanding. So these are things that we can train in. And it's interesting that when the Buddha speaks of that, and of course this is what the Buddha refers to as the middle way, and this middle way of practice, middle way of being, and this middle way that the Buddha realized is one which gives vision and gives understanding. And in the scriptural language, it's a chaku karlani, jnana karlani. Karlani is to give or to make, to create. This practice, this training, it gives us vision and understanding. So it's our kind of duty, or our the appropriate response of this towards this fourth noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of dukkha is that it's to be developed, it's to be cultivated, it's to be brought into being. The word that the Buddha uses is bhāve de bhanti, and the bhāve is the same word bhāvana. It's to be brought into being. It's to be cultivated. It's to be developed. So that this putting attention on the cultivation of these aspects of training, and realizing that we can train ourselves to to be peaceful. We can train ourselves to be clear and steady. And it's an option that we can exercise, and you know, and recognizing that we have many options, and we often make unskillful choices, and that's what that cultivation of, say, discernment and wisdom, understanding, so that we can make more skillful choices, make the choices that allow the heart to be more bright, more clear, more happy, to free the heart from dukkha. Because, you know, nobody gets up in the morning and sort of goes to the, you know, say, wash your face and brush your teeth in front of the mirror in the bathroom and look at oneself and say, yes, today I want to create more dukkha for myself. You know, it's just, you know, nobody does that. It's just, but we manage to do it. And it's all through just unskillful choices and not really understanding, not really seeing clearly. So that, you know, we're incredibly fortunate to have these teachings. And of course, today is a special day that we recollect the teachings that the Buddha gave us, and particularly this teaching on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. It's the foundation, it's the base that all of the teachings of the Buddha and of Buddhism are grounded in, and they can be included in this teaching. This is an image that actually Sariputta said, that it's like similar to the footprint of an elephant, in that the footprint of any other animal will fit in the footprint of an elephant. And the same with all teachings that are available that the Buddha gave us can be fit into these Four Noble Truths. Any teaching that leads to truth and understanding will inevitably, it's easy to fit it in this context of the Four Noble Truths. So these are some reflections for the evening. I'll offer that.